Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Sleep Like a Buck podcast. I'm Annika Carroll, your host, and I have Andrea Nicholson with me today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. You have a very interesting background, very interesting story. I think we're going to go into in a minute. You used to be a crime scene investigator, and you are now in the nutrition field, which is quite the turnaround or quite the turn of events there. So we'll discuss that in a second. And today we're all going to talk about what I really want to dive into with you is metabolic health and sleep and blood sugar and insulin and all the fun things that I see a lot of clients struggle with. And I think that a lot of people who struggle with sleep actually have that problem. And once we kind of understand that and see how we can help ourselves, we might even be able to improve our sleeps by ourselves, which would be fantastic. So what happened? Like, how did you get from a crime scene investigator into nutrition?
Yeah, it is a fascinating story. And, you know, usually I'm sure like a lot of us that end up in this kind of field, it's because we had our own story. And so while I was working that career, which on the surface seems totally unrelated and directly from a career standpoint is unrelated, but I was on my own journey while I had that career. And through that journey, I learned a lot about, you know, overall health, from how conventional medicine really wasn't helping me a whole lot. And then other alternatives. So it started with, in the back of my mind, I always knew that my entire birth family died very early of heart disease. They all had lots of heart disease problems. I didn't know a whole lot about it. I was adopted as an infant, so I didn't know like nitty gritty details. I didn't know a whole lot about how they lived, but I did know they were all overweight. A lot of them smoked and drank and, you know, so presumably didn't have the best lifestyles, but I didn't really know details. So that was always kind of in the back of my mind of something to be mindful of. Law enforcement obviously has a tremendous heart disease risk. It's a high stress job. It's weird hours. It's, you know, all the things that put you at greater risk. And my employer at the time actually brought in a cardiologist team that did this high level testing. Yeah. And in my 20s, I was like, all right, well, this will be a good baseline, because I couldn't get my regular GPs to really take me seriously. They were like, you're in your 20s, you're skinny, you're, you know, you don't have any issues. So they like wouldn't even barely run a basic lipid panel. So they brought this cardiologist panel in and they did the carotid scans and they did the EKGs and the stress tests and like all these things and the NMR lipid profile. So not only the standard lipids, mm-hmm. but also the particle sizes and, you know, the much more deep impression of what's going on with your cholesterol values. And so mid-20s, went through this test. I was maybe 30 pounds overweight, nothing significant, no health issues, no medications, no nothing. And I thought I was doing pretty good. I had a biology degree, you know, I knew a decent amount about health, and it came back really scary. I already had plaques forming. My arterial age was older than my chronological age. It was already thickening and hardening. Cholesterol panel was all the wrong kinds. I had the small, dense, oxidized particles, just like all the things were bad. Even though I wasn't overweight, I didn't have overt symptoms. I didn't smoke ever a day in my life. I really had a pretty reasonably good lifestyle. At the time, I wasn't really big on exercise. It was just not my thing. But that was probably the only thing I thought was lacking. Mm-hmm. And of course, even this high-level cardiologist was like, yeah, just, you know, eat a heart-healthy diet, don't smoke, stay a healthy weight. Like, he still couldn't even offer me any advice of how this was happening. So I did what I could. I started working out, lost the weight, you know, did as much as I could on a heart healthy diet, you know, olive oil and fish and those kinds of things. I did lots of whole grains and whole vegetables and, you know, all whole foods. I wasn't eating really processed foods. Went back a year later, redid the same panel, and everything was worse. Doing all of the standard advice, all these whole grains and all these whole vegetables and low fat and good sources of fat, like olive oil and just all these things. And I had started working out. I had lost 30 pounds, so I was seemingly healthier. And yet now my arterial age was 11 years older than I was. Like, everything just went the wrong direction and it just frustrated me. So that's what kind of started my journey. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really found functional medicine at that point. But that's what spurred me into really learning more and getting into the weeds of what to really do if conventional medicine can't help. And so I kind of put on my investigator lab coat, which is where the career kind of comes in. I was a trained investigator, so I dug in and did research and investigated what was really going on. And that's what ultimately led me to where I am today.
Wow, what a story. And like, you know what always makes me, it makes me mad that then doctors, I think it's great that they already did that advanced testing, right? Like for a back in the day, like even today, that's a big discussion with the practitioner to get that kind of lipid panel done often, right? But that they then don't have anything to say other than eat heart healthy and move around, which, yeah, generally not the wrong kind of advice. But if it doesn't help you, right, it doesn't. Right.
You're already doing those things.
Yeah.
That's not helpful.
Wow. And do you, like, reflecting on your journey now, do you know what made it worse?
Yeah. And what I ultimately ended up learning as I underwent additional, you know, comprehensive blood panels and functional testing and just learning all the things. And, you know, I use myself as a guinea pig all the time, and I always run new tests and things on myself. Ultimately, what I found over the many years of my own investigation was I had insulin resistance that was never diagnosed because they were only looking at blood sugar and occasionally an A1C, and they were never looking at all the other factors. So I had, that was a big problem, and it was trending. I wasn't like fully pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetic at that point. I was catching it early enough, but it was trending in the wrong direction, and it was setting me up for that internal inflammation and arterial calcification and all of those kinds of things. The exercise did help a little bit with like changing the particle sizes and improving HDL and that kind of thing. So that helped a little bit, which was lacking from the very first test. So some of it was lifestyle related, you know, just really going from absolutely anti-fitness to, you know, doing anything. And I actually started doing quite a bit. I kind of found my passion for fitness through that journey, which worked out really well. So I didn't have to continue fighting that battle. But then from a dietary standpoint, you know, I was eating good whole foods, or at least what I thought at the time were good whole foods. When I look back at it now, I realize that I really wasn't. I mean, I was eating a lot of whole grains, which sounds whole. It's got whole in the name, but really those are highly refined. You know, there was a lot of whole grain pasta and whole grain bread, and those are still highly refined foods. And when I look at my totality of what I was eating, because I was trying to stay low fat, I ended up also going pretty low protein, because you actually need adequate fat to break down protein. It stimulates all those same digestive enzymes and stomach acid and bile acids and all the things that we actually need to break down those foods. I was eating primarily plants. And we hear a lot about this today, that this is the best diet, that we can all go plant-based. And I don't have a problem with plants. I'm certainly not an anti-plant person. But when I look at what I was eating in totality, I was primarily eating plants. When you look at that from a macronutrient ratio, that's all carbs.
Yeah.
Plants are carbs. So obviously there's a variable range of how many carbs, depending on the kind of plant. But still, if you're eating exclusively plants, you're primarily only eating carbs, which is going to drive insulin resistance, blood sugar issues, all of those metabolic issues. And then on the side of that, you would think all of that amazing fiber, which I was eating probably 75 grams of fiber a day, like a really
That's
high
a
amount
lot.
Of fiber.
Yeah.
And I was chronically constipated. I had no idea. That was just my normal. I mean, I can remember back to being a little tiny kid. It was just my normal. I had no idea that that was a thing. And that was another thing I uncovered through this investigation was, just because it's your common or your normal state doesn't make it ideal. And I had a lot of things like that that were not ideal, that when I actually learned about what to look for, what to pay attention to, I had a lot of those other kind of underlying issues that I was able to correct once I knew. And that made a big difference too. So healing my gut, fixing the, you know, insulin resistance picture, adding more protein and healthy fats in made a huge difference.
Right. And now we've talked about, you've used a few terms already, like insulin resistance and stuff. So maybe we'll unravel that a little for people. And when I introduced you, I said we were going to talk about metabolic health. And that's something that I think a lot of people, if you're listening to a podcast here and there in the health space, something that you hear a lot. People talk about metabolic health, and people often talk about the fact that, and I'm just going to use Americans because that's the number I know. I think us, like here in Canada, it's probably not that far off. That the numbers are, I think, 6 to 8% of Americans are metabolically healthy, meaning 92 to 94% are not. And metabolic health and sleep are very much related. And metabolic health is just so crucial. So maybe can we dive into that a little? What is metabolic health? How is that defined? And why is it so important?
Yeah, it's a big topic. And most likely, if you ask 100 people, you'll get 100 different answers. Unfortunately, that's just kind of the nature of a lot of things in health. Unfortunately, the way I look at it, I think most people think of, you know, metabolism. It's the number of calories you're burning. Like, you know, do you burn a lot of calories, that kind of thing. But really, metabolism is all of the chemical reactions occurring in your body throughout the day. So this is synthesizing, you know, hormones and enzymes and muscles and tissue and new cells and new organelles and all of these things. And then it's also the breakdown of all of those same things when we're done with them, when they're worn out, when they're, you know, have a problem. Nutrients, as we take them in, we have to break them down, absorb what we want, get rid of the waste. It's all of these different things that are happening throughout the entire body. So it's not just as simple as calories in, calories out. It's not even really about calories at all. It's really about those synthesis reactions or making new things, and then also the breakdown or catabolism of different products. And so it really relates to your entire body.
So, and how would somebody be metabolically healthy?
Yeah. So if you're truly metabolically healthy, again, this is one of those, there's lots of different criteria that you can look at. A lot of the studies that have shown this, like 6 to 8% kind of thing, are looking at a couple of metrics. Mm-hmm. One being things like your waist circumference, you know, how obese are you? And specifically around the waist, because that can point to some of that visceral obesity or the fat around your organs where it's the most risky. That's also a place where no matter how fit or strong you get, you can't really bulk up in your midsection. You can't like add a bunch of muscle and look like you're obese when really you're lean. So that's one of the reasons why they like that measurement, because you can make it smaller by getting healthier, but you really don't have any control over making it bigger in a healthy way. So it's a good measure for that. So that's one. There's also things like looking at your blood pressure. You know, are you within an ideal blood pressure range all the time? You know, outside of that moment of, you know, if something startles you or whatever. But for the most part, you know, is your blood sugar or blood pressure at a good rate? Blood sugar is also a marker of this, specifically fasting glucose, but it can also be, you know, how high does your glucose go with your meals? How long does it stay high after eating? All of these kinds of things. How efficiently is your body able to handle that blood sugar so that it doesn't stay too high, but it also doesn't plummet too low? We can also look at the insulin, which is directly related to blood sugar, but it also has other roles. So it's not only about blood sugar. It's also a growth stimulator. So it has a lot to do with, you know, tissue development. We naturally have higher insulin levels like during puberty when you're growing or when you're pregnant because you're growing and you're growing another human being, you know, all of these kinds of things. So insulin has lots of different roles, but that's another one that we can really look at. You can look at your lipid panel. What are your triglycerides doing? What's your HDL doing? All of these kinds of things. So depending on which publications you're looking at, they look at these various different criteria. Some will look at BMI or body weight or, you know, these kinds of things. But for the most part, that's what they're looking at, is those metabolic markers of ideal health. And the people that are truly considered metabolically healthy are within the ideal range of all of them. Don't have any of those out of whack. And so that's why it's such a small population of people that qualify in that, because most of the population have at least one of those criteria that are not in the ideal range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think like just the one thing that comes to mind is probably like weight is probably something for a lot of people. Yeah. Lipids is something we don't see unless we actually look at blood. So you can't really judge it from just looking at somebody, but just from working with clients, I think a lot of people's blood panels aren't great, and unfortunately, blood sugar too. I just have one client who started working with a continuous glucose monitor. He was actually diabetic, is now pre-diabetic, like worked himself a great way down. But it's fascinating to see, right? Like how sensitive the body can be or not, and how simple things can actually make great progress in your health. With when it comes to like blood glucose and stabilizing glucose and stuff, it's fascinating. So, but why is it so important? And I guess you kind of talked about that with your journey a little. Why is this being metabolically as healthy as we can so important?
Well, because it relates to all of the chemical reactions in your body. If anything is kind of out of alignment there, it's going to affect something.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think, you know, you have high blood pressure. Okay. So that increases your risk of heart disease, but it also increases your risk of other things. You know, your blood is what's transporting everything around. And if it's sludgy or clogged up or, you know, just not as efficient as it should be or weakened, then you're not carrying nutrients very well. And if you are damaging some of the synthesis processes, then you might be losing muscle mass or collagen or connective tissues. And so you get saggy and flabby and, you know, more joint pains and more injuries, those kinds of things. So if we can't make new tissues, if we can't recycle these things, we age quicker, we fall apart quicker, we feel more inflammation and these kinds of things. Metabolic health also relates directly to how every organ in your body works. And this can show up in a variety of ways. You might have just one particular organ that takes the hit. You mm-hmm. might have a whole bunch. So you may see cognitive decline. You may see liver imbalances or detoxification problems. You may find other nutrient deficiencies because your digestive system isn't working that well and you're not absorbing those good nutrients, even if you're eating them. You're just eliminating them. And so there's all of these things that can just go wrong if you have any of these metabolic imbalances. And so you just kind of never know where it's going to set up for you. So you might see it in your brain, you might see it in your digestion, you might see it in your joints, you might see it in your skin, you might see it in weight gain or an inability to lose weight. You might see it in sleep issues, which contribute to all of those same things. I mean, it just can show up in a variety of ways. And really, if you fix that metabolic imbalance, it may just solve the other problems.
Absolutely. And like you just brought it up with, you could see it in your like cognitive ability. And like, and I'm a huge, well, with sleep, I'm a huge advocate for mental health. And I see, because we've had Alzheimer's dementia in the family. And it's, and people might have heard this, that it's talked about type 3 diabetes, Alzheimer's, and it's for a reason, right? It's because we were metabolically unhealthy and we were likely diabetic, that this is a slippery slope, that this is going to affect brain health. And then mm-hmm. we're going to just set ourselves up more for risks of all these kinds of, like, who wants heart disease? Who wants dementia? Who wants a stroke? Who wants any of these unfortunately common aging issues right now that we have, right? Can be, I would say, trimmed down significantly. If we can prevent them, there might be other reasons sometimes, right? But your risk can be so reduced if your metabolic health is in check.
Yes.
And yes, I agree. Sleep and metabolic health are like, well, either best friends or enemies, like which would depend on which way you look at yeah. it, right? But can you talk about that a little? How is, what are you seeing with people who are not metabolically healthy in their sleep? Or where do you think metabolic, the lack of metabolic health might interfere with sleep?
Yeah, I think if we start with, first of all, why did you get whatever metabolic imbalance you have?
Yes.
What actually led there?
Yes.
Primarily, it's diet.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest driver of these things, outside of, you know, genetic abnormalities and things that are super, super rare. The ones that you literally can't do anything about, those are super rare. So please don't try to blame that unless you've actually had that diagnosed. I can't really put a percent on it, but a huge portion of what causes metabolic dysfunction is diet.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just start there. So if you're eating a poor diet, and contributing to these metabolic dysfunctions. How that relates to sleep is in a couple different ways. Number one, if you're eating late at night or over consuming in general, and so you're still busy digesting when you go to bed, that interferes with your sleep process. Mm-hmm. It'll raise your body temperature. It'll raise your pulse. It'll keep you from really being able to either fall asleep or stay asleep. That's one way that it can interfere with sleep. The opposite end of that, if you're like a chronic dieter or someone who's under eating, which I think I even fell into this, even though I wasn't trying to under eat, because I was eating low protein and low fat, I was actually relatively low nutrient and low calorie. And so I was still kind of in that chronically low status. Your blood sugar can actually crash in the middle of the night because mm-hmm. you don't have enough to, you know, utilize all throughout the night. And when your insulin is elevated all the time because of the either poor diet or high carbohydrate diet or, you know, any of these imbalances, when your insulin is high, you can't break down stored fuels for energy. It blocks all the hormones that you need to be able to do those things. And so that leaves you hungry and it leaves you starving for blood sugar. And so it wakes you up because you literally could die if you go too low. And so you get a little bit of a cortisol spike, which does raise your blood sugar a little bit, wakes you up. It might keep you awake for a while. You may wake up really, really hungry or with a headache, you know, all of these kinds of things. So we can either end up with high blood sugars that are keeping us awake because we're busy digesting and it just interferes with sleep, or we can end up with these crashing blood sugars that wake you up because it could literally kill you. And so those are two really common things that can happen with metabolic health in general. And then beyond that, when you're in this kind of roller coaster of either always high blood sugars and the high insulin that then prevent you from breaking down anything stored, or the roller coaster of, you know, high when you eat and then crashing afterwards, that leaves you craving more food.
Mm-hmm.
It leaves you, you know, kind of in that whole mode of now you really want even more junk food and you'll just eat whatever you can get your hands on, which just furthers the problem. And so then your lack of sleep contributes to the metabolic health issues because now you're eating even worse and you're eating more often and, you know, you're falling into that whole cycle, which then you can't sleep because of what you just ate. And then it starts this whole cycle of poor sleep leading to poor eating habits, which leads to poor sleep, which, and then it just propagates and it just continues on and on. And so we really have to get a hold of that diet first.
I totally agree. It's like, it becomes this vicious cycle that we have to break, right? And then once we add what I would consider like not ideal, bad diet to it, so maybe lots of processed foods, ultra processed foods, inflammatory foods, then we add the inflammation component, then we raise cortisol because it's an anti-inflammatory, then we have the whole stress response ongoing, right? And then sleep also just becomes so difficult because your body is just constantly, like, it's literally on fire, mm-hmm. right? It's, yeah, and I agree. And how, what would you say, what are some dietary things like that people should evaluate? Like, maybe not even do, but if I'm at home and I'm wondering, oh, maybe I'm somebody who's trying to sleep, but I wake up and this could be something because I sometimes am actually hungry. Because if you had that, that's actually a great sign because then we kind of know where to go. Because yeah. If you're actually saying I'm hungry, what would you evaluate with somebody who says that? Like, how would you look at their diet?
Yeah, I think the first thing to really look at is, you know, what are the foods you're eating? Just take a really good, honest look at what you're eating. How much of it comes in a bag or a box or a package with a barcode on it versus a whole real piece of food, you know, something that you would have found potentially in nature, you know, a whole piece of meat or a whole vegetable, those kinds of things. So take a really good, hard look at the food you're consuming. If you're eating a fair amount or, you know, with every meal or with multiple, you know, times a day, if you're eating a lot of those foods that do come in bags, packages, barcode labeled things, you know, start there. Try to, mm-hmm. you know, work those out of your diet and fill those back in with good whole foods. If you're looking at your diet and you feel like, no, I'm actually eating a really good whole food diet, then you want to look at what is it made of? Like in my case, I was eating primarily all good, whole, fresh, you know, vegetables and that kind of thing. I was getting a little bit of the processed stuff with the grains, specifically with the whole grain pastas and breads and those kinds of things. So that would have been that, and that was the first thing I got rid of was the refined grains. But I was eating a lot of whole plants. So I would look then at what that's made of. And when I looked at it, it was like, oh, yeah, that's all plants. So I'm not getting enough protein. I'm not getting enough fats. Those kinds of things. And so then I was able to play with those levers and find the sweet spot for me where I didn't gain weight. You know, I didn't have any negative side effects. I had better energy. I felt better. I was absorbing things. I could see it in my skin. I could see it in my nails, you know, all these kinds of things that it was working for me metabolically. I was seeing a lot of positive signs. And so for you, that may be just really look at what you're eating. Are you eating a lot of one of the macros and maybe not so much of the others? And even within that, you know, there's individual variations. I don't think there's any like you have to eat this percentage of protein and this percentage of fat and this percentage of carbs. I do think protein is a major macronutrient that we need to focus on. We need to be making sure we're getting enough protein. How much is going to vary a little bit based on, you know, how much exercise you're getting, what age you're at, how much muscle mass you have now, how much fat mass you have now. Like there's all these other factors that go into how much that is specifically for you. But I do think protein is one that we have to prioritize. Healthy
And I
fats go along with those. Go ahead.
yeah. Oh, no, and I agree with that because I was vegetarian for like, I don't know, 12 years. And then I was then we all became we my husband and I went vegan for like 3 years because I had gut issues and I had my burnout and nothing, you know, when everybody said it's okay, I'm like, okay, I start with food, you know, and things improved, like constipation went away. It's like, oh, awesome. But 3 years in, my health was a disaster. Like my hormones were not happy. And even though I had fat in there, but it wasn't, there was no animal fat in there. I can't do dairy. And then I was like, I need to start eating. Like I was starting to dream about like animal protein, like fish and meat. I was like, but that's a sign, like I have to put it back in. And everybody was like, well, go slowly because your stomach acid might not be strong enough to like deal with it right away. You know, the minute I started that, like the whole world shifted. Everything got better. Energy got better. Blood sugar was so much more stable because you're not eating, because that's the thing, right? At least it was for me as a vegan. Like I was eating 6 times a day because I was always hungry. I'm like, I just had, and I literally said it. It's like, I just had lunch an hour ago. Like, and that was a big, whatever it was, like quinoa bowl with, you know, sweet potato, avocado, whatever, zinna beans. I'm like, why this can't be, like, where's this going? Like, and it wasn't that I was gaining weight or anything, but it was just like, this is not efficient use of time and energy. Like, it just can't be because there's nothing too satiating there. And then putting protein back in and consistently putting protein back in. So with every meal and actually focusing on it, you're right. It makes such a difference in energy, in mood, in, yes, appearance too. Nails, skin, hair for sure, but also sleep, right? Because you get, like you were just, you get that blood sugar stabilized and it will not tank at night. And I think for women, because you were just saying depending on your age too, like I'm getting into that perimenopausal phase and I can tell you, I can feel my metabolism shifting a little. Like it's just, I have to watch out. It's like, yes, do your exercises, get your protein so your blood sugar is more, you just do better. Because everything else is already all over the place in terms of hormones, right? So keep your insulin in check and keep your blood sugar stable so your cortisol is okay. So whatever other progesterones and estrogens don't affect it too much then on top, right? It's such a big thing, blood sugar. And maybe can you talk a little bit about blood sugar and insulin resistance, because people like, because insulin resistance is the precursor to diabetes, is the precursor to, I'm so convinced, is the precursor to Alzheimer's disease. So that's how they're linked and why then protein and all these things are so important.
Yeah, so insulin resistance, the way I look at it is there's two elements to it. One is your body is not really listening to that signal anymore. So it's just kind of toned it down. You can think of this, you know, everyone knows anyone that's ever done or has heard stories of people who've done, you know, illicit drugs or become addicted to any kind of opiate or any of those kinds of things, that you need a higher and higher and higher and higher dose to get the same effect. The same thing happens internally. If we're chronically high of anything, the body starts going, nope, not listening, not listening. And that could be for a variety of reasons. It could be something's blocking the receptors. It could be that you have less receptors. It could be that you have other inflammatory processes kind of interfering. There's lots of reasons for why the body stops listening, but ultimately it stops listening. And so it produces more and more and more. So with insulin resistance, what we find is you have elevated insulin and the body's not responding to it as efficiently. And this can happen at particular tissues. It generally isn't like a whole body-wide process. It generally does start at the tissues that are most responsive to insulin. But that would be the fat cells. And so now you're not responding as well to insulin there, which can increase your ability to store body fat. But it also happens at the muscle. It happens at the liver, which now you're piling fat into the liver where fat is not supposed to be stored. And so it really contributes to all of these issues. And so if your body's not listening to that signal of insulin as well, now you've got these really high levels of insulin that are preventing you from being able to use anything you've already got stored, which leaves you hungry, leaves you craving, leaves you desperate to eat yet again. But it also doesn't manage those blood sugars very well. So they either stay high because you need insulin to get the sugar out of the blood into the cells. That's the key that unlocks the door. So if you don't have the key, the sugar just stays in the blood, which is toxic. It's damaging. It damages your blood vessels. It damages any tissue it comes across. It can damage all the carrier proteins. All of these things become less and less efficient over time. But then you can't use that sugar for energy. So your brain suffers, your muscles suffer, you're hungry, you can't get any nutrients in other than you have to eat again. And generally, when you're in that kind of survival mode, you're so hungry or your cells are literally screaming for energy, you'll eat whatever you can find. And generally, that's going to be fast, junk, processed, quick absorbing. You know, you see this a lot even in like a type 1 diabetic where they have a hypoglycemic moment where their blood sugar crashes because they had too much insulin on board. They often will go for a juice, or they'll go for a candy bar, or they'll go for a straight up glucose tablet. And that's because it raises the blood sugar quickly enough that they deal with, you know, the moment of emergency. But that propagates the problem because now your body's going to release, well, outside of a type 1, your body's going to release even more insulin and you just fueled the whole problem again. So it really is a big deal that's interfering with how your metabolism is supposed to work.
And so diet is a huge thing there, that we're gonna look more really whole foods, take out the processed stuff, take out those high fructose corn syrup sodas and the candy bars and all that stuff that just spikes your blood sugar up, is gonna tank, you're gonna be on that roller coaster, exactly what you're describing. So that's a bad thing. How about if we wanna help with that? How about lifestyle? Like if we're talking movement, if we're talking stress management, do these play a role in that?
They absolutely do. I think diet's the number one. We have to dial that in first. You're not going to move the needle very much if you keep eating the way you're eating and try to do all these other things. But if you fix the diet and don't fix all the other things, you'll also only get so far. So it absolutely does play a role. So really prioritizing the good sleep is going to be huge because that plays into the stress picture, that plays into the metabolic process picture, that plays into, you know, just your body repairing and all the things that it does during sleep. So sleep is one that we really do need to prioritize, good quality sleep, getting adequate amounts of that. Stress management absolutely plays a role because one of our key stress hormones is cortisol, and cortisol's primary duty is to raise the blood sugar to give you enough energy to deal with whatever the threat is. So even outside of eating anything, you can have high blood sugar just because you're stressed. And you can see this very clearly on someone who's using a CGM. They can be sitting on the couch, not eating anything, having not eaten anything for hours, watching a suspenseful movie or something startles them and their blood sugar will go through the roof. Now, it generally will come right back down for something like that because that's not a chronic problem. That's a temporary something that startled you. But for those of us that are stressed all the time, like those in law enforcement, like those working shift work or, you know, emergency medicine or, you know, any of these just really stressful jobs, traveling for a living across different time zones, you know, any major deadlines, recurrent problems, all of these kinds of things, recurrent financial issues, relationship strife, past trauma that you haven't dealt with. All of these things are stressors and you're constantly spiking your cortisol just enough that it really never comes back down. That's keeping your blood sugars elevated all the time. So we do have to get a handle on those stressors. And that also involves, you know, poor gut health, toxin exposures, underlying infections. These are also stressors on the body that can contribute to all the problems. So it's not just the kind of emotional stressors that we think of, although that's the bulk of what is chronically behind it, but it can also be an injury that you never got fully healed.
Yeah.
You know, it can be any of these kinds of just things that you deal with routinely all the time. They're all stressors. Exercise is a big one. And this one, interestingly enough, is kind of a Goldilocks thing. You can overdo it on exercise and actually end up stressing your body more. And we see this a lot in people who are competitive athletes, marathoners, you know, endurance athletes, where they train a lot to be really good at these long, stressful events. And it really does break down a lot of tissue. It keeps cortisol high. It really can contribute to a lot of issues. Doesn't mean you don't do it. Doesn't mean you should stop running, but you do need to be mindful of overtraining, especially if you start seeing like more and more negative side effects. You're getting sick more often. You're losing muscle tone. Your workouts are getting weaker and weaker as you go. Your sleep is more disturbed. All of these kinds of signs, if things are going in kind of the wrong direction, that could be a sign that you're overtraining. That's generally only going to be true in someone who's working out for hours and hours a day. But it can also be true, at least in a temporary state, for someone who went from no exercise to a lot of exercise.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major stress.
Yeah, or a lot of my ladies who, if they don't sleep, go an hour a day on a Peloton bike because, you know, the weight's starting to creep in for all the reasons, basically because your metabolism isn't doing well. Because your cortisol is constantly elevated and you're not breaking down the nutrients that you're taking in. And then you're trying to burn that in a spinning class, ridiculously often, or high intensity training, interval training. Like if your body isn't at that state, I think you might agree with there's other types of movement or exercise we can do to help our body use that glucose, that sugar that's in the blood, right?
Yeah. I think one of the absolute easiest things to do is walk.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically go for a walk after you eat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you eat a higher carb meal, go for a longer walk. If you eat a reasonably low carb meal, if you have, say, steak and broccoli, you don't need to go for a 2-hour walk. You don't need to go for this exceedingly long walk. But even a super low carb meal will, you know, need some blood sugar to be burned off. And so if you don't want that to be stored, go for a walk. And you can see it again on a CGM. You can see on a day when you don't go for a walk, you can see what your blood sugar does. And then when you eat that exact same meal at the exact same time, you know, trying to keep as many things as consistent as possible, but you go for a walk afterwards, you can see how much difference it makes.
It's such an easy thing. It is an easy thing. And it is fascinating if people are using continuous glucose monitors. Like you can literally see the spike coming, and that's fine because after every meal, blood sugar is going to go up. We just want it to come down, right? But it's, if you then go for a walk or you go on a treadmill or you do, like you can see the spike, you can see it turn sometimes. It's like, if you actually measure along, it's like, oh, we just stopped it. We are actually using the muscle tissues sponging up that sugar. It's like, it's fascinating. How technically easy is that to, yes, we have to do it, but how easy is it to go for a 10-minute, 15-minute walk, brisk walk if you can, after you've eaten?
And the cool thing about that, about adding exercise specifically after eating, is it doesn't require insulin. When your muscles are active and they're actually, you know, flexing and contracting and doing all of the things that our muscles do when we're walking or exercising, you don't need insulin for that. Your muscles will readily soak up all the glucose to keep your muscles going, and it doesn't use insulin. So this is a fantastic way to help lower your overall insulin load because you don't need it. You can burn off that sugar without needing the insulin. That doesn't work when you're just sedentary. You need insulin then to get the sugar into your muscles if they're not active. But if you're exercising or moving around or using your muscles in any way, you don't need the insulin.
Well, this is fascinating. It is. How long do you think, like, if somebody's really not, like, let's say they're pre-diabetic or even diabetic, like they're not doing well, so well, and they'll start doing these practices, like starting to shift their diet, starting to put more walking on their schedule. How long do you think people need to actually see a change in numbers?
You know, I see it really quickly.
Okay.
You know, depending on how big of a change people make, you know, how bad it was and then how good they get it kind of thing, how big that spectrum is going to depend a little bit on how long that takes. Also, how long you've been in that state. You know, if you've been a type 2 diabetic for 20 years, it's going to take a little bit longer than someone who maybe is still just in that early trending stage, but they haven't been there for very long. So, you know, be mindful of those kinds of things as well, but it can turn around really quickly where you can at least see that it's working. And in some cases, I mean, you can see full reversal pretty quick.
Wow. Yeah, and I find it fascinating, like how the body can do that. We just have to give it the right tools and send the right signals to do that. I have a question for you in terms of nighttime, because you were talking about dinner, and I agree with that, like, or the, like the snacking that we sometimes maybe do after dinner. You know, it's like, oh, I'm taking a bag of chips and going on the couch and watching Netflix, this constant munching thing. Yes, that's not great, because at some point the body needs to be done digesting before we go to sleep, ideally, so we don't have, like you were saying, the heart rate going up, the body temperature not dropping, all those signals we need to fall asleep, right? But what if people actually have continue or regular night wakings? And they're like, yes, I do. It could be a blood sugar thing. What's your take on having a snack, a small snack, like half hour, hour before you go to bed?
I think this can be a helpful tool, or at least a temporary crutch. I don't think this should be a long-term proposition. I think as your metabolic health improves, you'll probably find that you don't need that snack anymore. The key to doing this well without making things worse is what that snack is. I think for the person who knows they're waking up and they're hungry, or they've tested and they know it's a blood sugar crash that brought them to waking up, for these low blood sugar moments, the best thing I've found is to have a protein and healthy fat combo snack. And it does not take like a plate of food. A couple of bites of something is all you need. So this could be for someone who can do dairy. It could be a piece of cheese. It could be some, you know, your favorite nut butter, if you like almond butter, or, you know, whatever that may be. Like one scoop could be all you need. It could be a couple bites of chicken, or, you know, something like that. It does not need to be a bowl of something, a plate of something. A couple of bites can make all the difference. And even if you don't know for sure that it's this low blood sugar problem that's contributing, this can be a way to find out. Because if you have this tiny little snack and you sleep through the night, you just solved your problem.
Yes.
Now, this isn't the obviously long-term answer, but that can tell you that either you're not eating enough during your meals, specifically protein and healthy fats, but it can also just be total food. You're not eating enough. And so your body has kind of burned through all of it. Or your insulin levels are still really high. And so you can only function on what you're eating. You can't break down those stored fuels. So depending on those, and you can determine some of this through lab testing if you really want to know what the distinction is. I would look at your meals first and see if you're eating enough and eating enough protein specifically. Play with that a little bit and see if you can find a sweet spot where you do feel more satiated. You don't wake up during the night, all of those kinds of things. You don't need that snack. If it's still continuing, then you might do some lab work and see where your insulin level is at, because then you can really dial in the diet to specifically bring that down. And, you know, that could be bringing carbs down even more. It could be adding in some fasting, changing up your exercise routine, those kinds of things. There's lots of different ways that we can really bring that insulin level back down. So I think a lot of it depends a lot on, you know, what's going on with you specifically. Is it an insulin issue? Is it an under-eating issue? Is it an under-eating protein issue? Is it an over-exercising issue? Is it, you know, we have to kind of know why it's happening. But I do think having that protein snack before bed, if you're one of those people that's waking up, can be something that can tell you a whole lot about why.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. It shouldn't be, and that's kind of, I think, how I use it too. It's like, it shouldn't be your long-term solution, right? There is something that we can improve to not have that happen, but to get you over that 3 a.m. hump, to get that sleep, to not have the next day of, I haven't slept well, so what am I going to do? I'm just going to eat more calories because I need more energy because I didn't restore overnight. And I'm, like you said, I'm not going for the salad with the chicken. I'm going for the muffin and the bagel and the quick stuff, right? Which then, then we're in that cycle. So with breaking that cycle that way, I think it's a great way to just understand what's going on and then dig deeper to fix the overall issue. What would you say, if you reflect back on your journey now, what would be like the 2-3 things if you had known this many years ago, what would you have done differently?
Yeah, I would have definitely prioritized the protein and the healthy fats more. I just really didn't know how much protein we really do need. And I think even today, there's ongoing research that's showing we've woefully underestimated how much protein we really need. And so there's more and more coming out about how much more protein we really do need. So I think, you know, making that a priority and making sure you're getting good quality proteins in addition to the, you know, total quantity. So that would have been, you know, one major thing, which also, like you, I no longer have to eat 6 times a day now that I'm eating much more protein. Mm-hmm. I literally was obsessed with food back in the day. While eating, I was already thinking about the next snack.
Yes.
I was always packing food and carrying it with me and worrying about what I was going to do when I was on a plane or in a meeting, or like, I don't even think about food anymore. And so I think once you kind of dial those things in and get your metabolism working the way it should, you should actually be able to go for a relatively long period of time, at least throughout a day, and be okay not eating. I mean, realistically, you should have adequate fuel on your body unless you're underweight, you know, don't have adequate body fat stores. You should be able to get through the day without eating. And so, you know, really working on that metabolic health for me made all the difference, bringing down those blood sugar levels, staying more satiated, those kinds of things. Part of the career that ended up being a detriment to me was the stress level. Mm-hmm. And I was on call. I mm-hmm. had random sleep schedules. I wasn't even aware of it at the time, but I actually was eating a fair amount of junk food because, you know, when you're out on a scene for 24 hours, they're bringing you fast food to eat because there is nothing else.
Yeah.
And so they're buying, you know, cheeseburgers or pizza for everyone that's working the scene. And so I was actually eating a lot of those things, even though I wasn't the one buying it, which is why I wasn't really thinking about it. Cause it's like, well, I don't order pizza. No, but I was eating it a couple times a week just because I was out on scenes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had random work schedules. I was seeing the worst of the worst of society every single day. Yeah. So just, you know, seeing terrible things and hearing terrible things and just, yeah. So the stress load was a big one. And I really wasn't prioritizing a whole lot of the stress management techniques. Mm-hmm. You know, exercise is a great one. Prioritizing good quality sleep, you know, avoiding stimulants and depressants and all the things to, you know, balance the sleep and awake cycles. I was way overusing lots of things to, you know, manage that, to, you know, fall asleep when I was high stressed and strung out and to wake up when I needed to get up at 2 a.m. and all the things. So stress management would be another one. And that doesn't necessarily have to mean you quit your job. Like I probably could have.
Yes.
With the skills I have today, I could have probably managed that stress much better. And certainly the diet as well. I could have been much more prepared and not eaten the food that was being provided that was always terrible. So I think those are the two things. And then, you know, the other big driver was the adding the exercise. Going from completely no exercise ever, even walking, other than what I had to do to get through the day, to actually adding strength training, walking, you know, yoga, those kinds of things, and prioritizing the breath that goes along with that makes a big difference too.
Great. This was great, Andrea. Thank you so much. This is so helpful. And I think this is such a topic, like this is a topic that is going to affect, I think if we're not working on it now, it's going to affect everybody in their life, because we are all just getting more and more metabolically unhealthy as we age. Some of it just by biology, right? And so we have to work against that. And yeah, like you said, and sleep is such a, it's like kind of like the chicken and the egg, right? If you don't do it, your metabolic health goes down. If you have issues with it, your metabolic health might be already going a bit downhill. And that might be why you're not sleeping, because your blood sugar isn't stable. This was so insightful. Where can people find you if they want to find out more, if they want to start working on their metabolic health or the health overall? Where can they find you?
Yeah, my website is healthylifewithandrea.com. And you can find, I have a bunch of free resources on there. I also have my own podcast, the Holistic Health Bites Podcast. You can find that on there as well. And yeah, if you're interested in learning more about what I do, you can book a free call.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you again next time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Sleep Like a Boss podcast. If you're struggling with sleep and have tried everything that Google, your friends, or Facebook groups have recommended, and you're still struggling, stop looking for that one thing to fix your sleep. The human body is complex, and one single supplement or lifestyle fix is likely not going to be the solution. Here on the Sleep Like a Boss podcast, we dig into all aspects of sleep for you and unravel the complexity. My name is Annika Carroll. I'm the new CEO of Sleep Like a Boss, and me and my team are here to end the epidemic of sleep deprivation. Let's get started. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sleep Like a Boss podcast with me, Annika Carroll. Be sure to follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. We also invite you to play the game of sleep with us, if you haven't done so, at sleeplikeaboss.com. This podcast is for informational purposes only. We hope you enjoyed the episode. And until next time, and to a good night's sleep.